This is episode 5 of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with guests John Sweeney and Philip Gishaw.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha and welcome to today's dialogue. In this episode, I'm joined by John Sweeney in Kazakhstan and Philip Gishaw in Australia. John is an assistant professor of futures and foresight at Narhos University in Almaty, Kazakhstan, and director at Kazakh Research Institute for the Future Studies, and a foresight advisor for Interpol. John has organized, managed, facilitated workshops and seminars, multi-stakeholder projects, and foresight gaming systems in both the public and private sector in over 45 countries around the world. Philip is the founder and creative director at D2 Design and Development. He's an award-winning international industrial designer with over 20 years of industrial and product design experience. He's also a TEDx speaker and presented on the topic, Redesigning Our World, Small Changes Equal Big Impact. Today's dialogue focuses in on the importance of the internarrative and how that shapes the lens and values through which leaders see the future. One point that John makes was in reference to a study that demonstrates how narrative and metaphor frames choices and future possibilities. In the study, titled Metaphors We Think With, The Roles of Metaphor in Reasoning, half the participants were given a metaphor about crime that described crime as a beast preying on the city. The other half of the participants were given a metaphor of crime as a virus infecting the city. The results revealed that metaphors systematically influenced how people proposed solving a city's crime problem. When crime was framed metaphorically as a virus, participants proposed investigating the root causes and treating the problem by enhancing social reform to inoculate the community, with emphasis on eradicating poverty and improving education. When crime was framed metaphorically as a beast, participants proposed catching and jailing criminals and enacting harsher enforcement laws. This just demonstrates the importance of that inner narrative and how that shapes our choices and our future possibilities. The dialogue also discussed the importance of self-awareness for foresight, creating safe spaces for experimenting through play and creativity, why command and control no longer works, the importance of collaboration for future leaders, and why foresight needs to be a part of companies' hygiene. Let's listen. So John and Philip, thank you for being here. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. As always, I want to start with this key question of what does it mean for leaders to be smart or intelligent about futures given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change we see in the world right now? And I'd love for John, if you could start and address that question from your perspective or, you know, your work.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tyler. It's a real pleasure to be able to join and to be able to share. I think from my perspective, smart leadership and forward-looking, intelligent leadership has to be clear. And that for me is an acronym. The first attribute or capacity is to be curious. The second is to be L for learning or unlearning. A commitment in E to experiment. A is for ambiguity and R is for reflective. And those are, I think, the key kind of skills and capacities, really the capabilities that leadership needs now in a world, as you said, that's very, very VUCA, very post-normal.
Cool. Thanks. And I'm sure we'll be able to expand on those ideas later on here. And Philip, how do you address that question from your perspective and your work?
I'm very impressed by John's structure already. So I feel, oh gosh, I'm really unprepared for that. but my take on it is I think we're facing a change in the world. We obviously, the technology is shifting to some green technology. There are a lot of things happening. The world's getting more and more connected. So the world in 20, 30 years is going to be completely different than what we know today. And it's going to be a very deep change that's going to affect a lot of people. So in terms of leadership, I think my take on that is that there are different layers. One that I really perceive is, I think leaders need to really have some deep sense of self-awareness. If they want to lead well, they have to understand themselves, their own boundaries, their own mind, their worldview, and everything, so that they can apprehend what's happening out there in a more calm and less frantic way. And then I think there's another layer on that is that we're moving from this kind of industrial age to, I don't know, something else. And that world will be more collaborative. So all the structure that we were told, the structure that we were experiencing in the world, in a working environment and everything, are in many ways no longer relevant. So we're going to move to more collaborative type of work and tools and structure and workflow. And I think the new leaders will have to be very comfortable with that new way of working, which in my opinion would be much more effective for everyone, much more pleasant as a work experience for everyone if this is done properly.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. And so, John, with your work, I guess going on this idea of collaboration, I know there's a lot of interest in, at least we had talked before, on this idea of people and places and values. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, I wanted to say that I really like what Philip said about, you know, focusing on the internal and having self-awareness, because so much of foresight work often focuses on the operational environment, right? You know, someone, you know, rings us up and says, hey, you know, tell me the future, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And of course, we say we can't predict the future. And a lot of my work now has actually been exactly what Philip has said, is saying, how do we get the inner narrative right? How do we get the framing for leadership, for the team, to understand the assumptions they have, the perceptual sort of framing and context, and how that gives us a certain lens on the future? Because as we know now, it's we're inundated with all this stuff, and the biggest challenge is the signal to noise ratio. It's finding the weak signal, finding the thing that's going to be impactful. And as you mentioned, Tyler, that has a whole lot to do with understanding and having a really clear sense as to, you know, our values as an organization and as leaders. You know, do we have clarity around, you know, what is it that is really driving us? Where is it that we really want to go? And are we using that, I think most importantly, to pull people into the future rather than to feel like we're pushing? And I say that because, you know, every organization has on the wall the mission statement, the vision, the values, and oftentimes that's not a very collaborative, participatory product. You know, sometimes there's a survey or there's a little bit of an engagement, but I think ultimately it's making that participation, that collaboration, the values-driven aspect part of the DNA of the organization. And that really starts at the top.
Very nice. Philip, you got some insights from that?
Oh, yeah. I really, what John said about clarity actually really resonates with me. And I was trying to take notes at the same time. And so if I start with the premises of what John started to answer, I think I see two types of future. I think there is one future, the one that we've been told. And if you look at the work of futurists and everything and what Silicon Valley is saying and everything, it's, you know, it's AI, it's robot, it's all that stuff. And it looks a bit threatening sometimes, you know, and but it's, for me, it's one future. And this is the only one or the main one that's been broadcasted. But there are other options for the future. And actually, the future is what we're going to build. So if we develop our own self-awareness, if we develop our more human and collaborative tools, then the future may not be what is depicted today. So that's the first layer of the answer. The second layer is really agreeing with what John also has been unfolding in his answer. Is I have a slightly different take on it, but I think the principles are very similar. I think if companies and people are driven by visions, like if they have a very clear picture of where they want to go, how, and maybe even a time frame around that, then they can move into storytelling. And storytelling is something I've been trying to study in the last few years, and I find this tool more and more powerful because it's very engaging and it bypasses the logical brain if you do that well. So if leaders are able to have a very clear vision and do storytelling very well, then the whole team has guidelines, very strong guidelines, and then it gets really easy to filter the noise that is around, because there is stuff that goes towards revision and then the rest, and so you can discard everything that distracts you and just have that clarity that John was talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting how this idea of having a very clear self-narrative or organizational narrative, and how that's really forming the lens for, you know, what stories you can tell, if you can even formulate a story properly or not. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you do that in your work, John, specifically?
It's always a process relative to the organization. And I really resonate with what Philip is saying around the importance of storytelling, because it does create, like I said, that pull for the organization, for even communities. And there's a really interesting study that a colleague often uses. He gives an example of some survey work that was done, and people were asked, given this kind of prompt, if crime is a beast, how do we respond? And if crime is a beast, and that's kind of the guiding metaphor, then people say build prisons. But if people are asked and told, okay, crime is a virus, how do we respond? They say, oh, education. So if the framing, if the narrative, if the metaphor is different, people respond in different kinds of ways. And this is why I couldn't agree more with Philip's point around, you know, that vision, that metaphor, that storytelling is really essential, because it speaks to us at a deeper level. And so, you know, with organizations, often it requires kind of first getting through the assumptions around foresight being very much around the operational environment. And I actually just had a workshop a few days ago where at the very last day, someone said, okay, but how do you assess, you know, what you said in 10 years, if it's true or not? And I said, wait a second. You know, we've just spent 2 days going over, hey, this is operational environment, but this is the internal, this is, you know, about perspective and assumptions and bringing those two together. So it's sometimes hard for people to get over, because there is this kind of expectation, but also the kind of the blaring noise of all the, you know, the futurist predictions that are out there. But my work specifically is about, you know, finding that midpoint, finding the point where the external and the internal really bleed and blend together. And so you have to have the inner narrative right to look out and to see where you want to go. And again, it's a process, and it takes time, but it's something that I think organizations have done and continue to do well, those that really commit to it. And again, make it part of their DNA as an organization.
That's great. And Philip, in your work as well, how do you help tell story, or how do you help connect that inner narrative to the outside world?
Yeah, that's interesting, because my work is about hardware, physical products. So it seems on the surface quite different. But actually, I believe that even though the outcome is different, the principles are the same. I was having a conversation on Friday with a few entrepreneurs, and we were talking about what really matters. And if you dive really down, I think what matters is really the intent, or the intention that you put forward. And the rest is the result of the intent and the intention. So if the intention of the CEO and the company is to, you know, grow as aggressively as possible and destroy competition and everything, and then you have all the examples out there of that already. So I don't need to put any names. You can picture a few already by yourself. But if you have a different intention, like playing the long game, or the infinite game, as Simon Sinek would say now, then you can navigate in a whole different context that you build for yourself. And I believe if leaders have really the right intention, then the rest can really unfold quite nicely.
That's great. And John, do you have any follow-ups on that, thoughts?
Yeah, I think that, you know, setting the attention is something that, you know, a lot of organizations and even leaders, is something that is, you know, they don't teach you that in an MBA program, right? So you have to, you know, you kind of have to find your way to it. And obviously we've got lots of, you know, new processes and methods and approaches for doing that. I've really found play to be an extraordinarily useful, you know, strategic and tactical approach for how to actually introduce the kind of, you know, reflectiveness, to introduce the ambiguity, such that, you know, what is preferred and unpreferred becomes quite clear. So whether it's a simple role play game simulation, or whether we're doing more, you know, complex, dynamic, interactive, you know, games, it's something that, you know, creates a certain kind of space. On the one hand, people feel maybe a bit, you know, they can let down their guard because we frame it as a game or a simulation. But then you really unpack it and you realize that the opportunity to create insights around that, such that, you know, this intentionality can become really clear, is something that, again, I found really fruitful. And I've been using a variety of contexts.
Yeah, it's interesting. A friend of mine, who's a neuroscientist, talked a lot about play as a huge opportunity within organizations or teams to interact in ways that are new, because you know, of course, it's typically a little less stressful because it's not as serious, but you can also create a space where you can give 100%, right? So, and even if you fail, it's okay in these, because it's kind of like an experiment. So really framing things within the idea of play and creating experiences that are playful, super valuable.
Yeah, I can. Do you mind if I bounce back on this
one?
Yeah,
please. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I was trying to understand why that play was resonating with me also as deeply as it had. I think because I'm a creative and then we do some creative work, part of creativity is really dealing with ambiguity for sometimes a long time, enabling chaos at times and enabling discomfort and remaining in uncomfortable zone for as long as needed to have then at the end a creative output. And it's a form of a play too. It's a form of it's a place where if you have the psychological safety around you, then you can express pretty much anything you want. And the ratio is pretty bad, actually. Like you probably have 9 bad ideas for a good one. So you really need to have that space where you can display all those 9 or 99 bad ideas so that eventually you get to the good one. So yeah, it's very interesting, that idea of play and creativity, I guess, for me.
Yeah, I know you do it with your work, John, through actually creating games, right? Foresight games?
Yep. Yeah, so oftentimes that means, you know, creating custom games and simulations. And of course, you know, there's kind of some stock models you kind of lean upon. But I actually really like having the challenge and the opportunity to, you know, work with different organizations and do that. So for example, I've been working on gaming with Interpol, Dubai Police. I'm actually participating in a government leadership program here in the UAE, and we've got some games we're gonna put to people. And of course, I like creating the games, but I also like making the turn where now we're gonna make a game. So how do you get people into a space to kind of, you know, go from player to creator? And I think this resonates with what, you know, Philip is saying, is, you know, can you set things into place where people can take the ownership and try to find ways of creating? And so getting people to actually make games. And that's something, again, that is not necessarily, or, you know, intuitive, or is necessarily even taught. So it's a skill and capacity that I think challenges people to think about uncertainty and complexity in new and interesting kinds of ways.
How have you seen that, like using the idea of games and play, how have you seen that kind of change the inner narrative or the ability to tell stories in the experiences?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, oftentimes, as we mentioned, it kind of, you know, lets down people's guards. So, you know, within the game, I often try to balance the competition versus collaboration relative to kind of incentives and the models of gameplay. So, you know, the biggest, I think, absolute takeaway that people often have is that they feel that the whole command and control mentality and approach simply doesn't work. So a lot of the games actually involve very intentional interventions of innovations or disruptions. So, you know, people are kind of moving either from the present to the future, and they encounter these things, or they find themselves in a very different future environment where they're, you know, nothing is essentially familiar. So at the highest level, I'd say at the leadership takeaway, it's fundamentally about confronting that ambiguity, right? Confronting the lack of control or the lack of certainty. And I think that's really what games make tangible, is, you know, the capacity to not be afraid of uncertainty, but to feel comfortable in those spaces and to be able to then set an intentionality, as Philip had said, and use that as kind of what can pull people forward. So it oftentimes emerges in the debrief, right? Sometimes you have the play experience, which can sometimes be very intense. And then you kind of, you know, have to bring people down and kind of get into more of a reflective space. And then usually it's in that space that the kind of aha, you know, moment really comes up.
Philip, in your experience kind of playing on this idea, how do you use your work to kind of design playful spaces or spaces that allow creativity to emerge?
Yeah, I was trying to listen to John, and there's a lot of, again, a thing that really resonate. I think with a slightly different twist, because of the creative work that I'm doing, I think the most important angle at the beginning is to create psychological safety. So you need to make sure that the team is at ease and comfortable sharing whatever they want to share. And there are no stupid questions, no stupid answer, no stupid ideas. It's just anything you want to share, you are free to share it. And sometimes people think they have a stupid idea, but actually it's brilliant. If I can just share a 30-second story, I did, when I was 23 or something like this, I did a creativity training, mainly because I thought of myself as being creative and I wanted maybe to, be a bit proud of that or something. And that was a 2-day training. And there were about 20 people in the room. There were someone from advertising, a designer like myself, and more engineer and ordinary people around the table too. And the founder of the group was trying to tease us because we were so-called creative people. And after 2 days, someone raised their hand at the back, and that was someone from accounting, and she just said, yeah, but how about we do this? And that was probably like the best idea from far from anything we heard during the whole weekend. And I think it's very important. So there are a number of layers here. First is if you create a psychological safety, people can really speak out and share what they think about the, you know. Second is it's not because you're not told you're creative that you're not creative. Everyone's a creative. You need to create the right environment so that people can really relax and then share really what they think about a problem or a question that's been raised. And the last bit is more around the outcome. So in my line of work, people buy innovation. That's the outcome they want. But they don't want to buy the messy process that leads to innovation. So everyone wants to buy the light bulb. No one wants to buy the 10,000 prototype that's going to fail to lead to the light bulb. So there's a bit of a tension here. And I understand that people are really outcome driven, but you cannot have what I call real innovation, like a breakthrough or something that is really tangible that has really more value and not iterative. You cannot have that breakthrough if you don't have that process of a bit of chaos, a lot of failing and learning curves and trials and errors and everything. And that goes back to the psychological safety. If the team is not allowed to fail and comfortable with failing and learning is not a failure, it's not bad, but it's just, you know, closer to the breakthrough, then it's very likely you're going to have better innovation versus if you have a stressful environment where you can't really speak up and you're really too driven by the results.
Yeah, it seems like there's this definitely this connection here between the state or the state of the people and the context of the experience and how that drives the results and the outcomes of the process. And it seems to be even in the foresight space and in the creative innovation space that it's important for both. For both of you, do you feel like there's either a lack of attention to that or resistance to that in your fields of work?
Yeah, I think it's becoming more and more relevant and something that's more practiced. So there are lots of leading practitioners now who are have really changed the conversation in the foresight space. So the one in particular, I think, is Sohail and Ayatollah, who his work has really inspired my own and a lot of focus on inner narrative. And I liked what Philip said about kind of the psychological safety and you know, linking that up with games. You know, all players come to the table equal, right? Everyone has an equal footing in the game. So, you know, we don't give the boss extra tokens because they're the boss, right? So that means that we try to democratize the space or level the playing field as much as possible. And the other thing I think that really resonates is the, you know, is often the tyranny of the KPIs, you know, and how do we make curiosity a KPI? You know, what does that look like? You know, how do you make experimentation a KPI? So, you know, thinking about the kind of openness, the kind of safety, the opportunity at the highest level to really shift the cultural paradigm such that people feel like they're able to do these things. Because, you know, the best ideas, I think Philip nailed it, you know, don't come from the core often. They come from the periphery. So just a quick anecdote in this 4-day engagement I have with the Dubai Police, one of the most engaging, dynamic, really involved, absolutely insightful participants was a drill instructor from the police academy. And this guy was, you know, he's a super young guy, like, but just really plugged in. He was learning Japanese by himself. Just he was the epitome of who you want to have on your kind of foresight team. But he didn't at all fit the profile of the kind of folks that, you know, that you might sort of, you know, try to bring in or assess. And just a really fascinating guy. And I'm actually going to meet him later today because I want to, you know, inspire him and keep him going on his journey. And and I think that's just it. Like, you know, it's not always the usual suspects. It's oftentimes you want to have that diversity in the room, and diversity itself has been shown to be a great asset for making innovation better.
Yeah, when I worked with a Rolls-Royce, they always made sure that they had aliens in the room. That's what they called them. You know, people who didn't really seem like they would fit in the room in that discussion, but they probably could add something that they weren't aware of, you know, into the space. And you, Philip, how about you? Have you seen resistance, or do you see people using a lot of this idea of inner narrative, self-awareness, and creating a safe space?
I think there are two trends. I would tend to see there's this kind of dying trend where people are driven by what John said, the tyranny of the KPI. Like, they, you know, I see those companies, they really want to buy the result. they don't want to know how you do it, but they don't want to handle the chaos, the uncertainty. They want to buy certainty, and they, you know, it's kind of old school driven and really like numbers and time driven and everything. And that doesn't quite work because that's not how creativity or real innovation works. I was trying to bounce back also on what John said, which is when the real creative outcome or the real positive outcome doesn't really come from, you know, the mainstream, come from the edges and everything. And I kind of relate to the work in the creative process. The creative process for me has three stages. The first one is immersion. If you need to create, I don't know, a new car, you need to understand what car are. If you need to create a new table, you need to understand what the table is. So you need to really understand what the context is about, what type of table for which type of market, and so on and so forth. The second stage is doing the work. There's no way around that. You need to sit on the table and sketch and fail and throw away papers or erase your tablet or whatever, but you need to sketch over and over again. And one exercise I was given when I was a student is to do 500 sketches, because it's impossible to do 500 times the same sketch or the same idea. It's going to drive you mad. Mm-hmm. So you go through a whole emotional journey, and then that leads to a breakthrough. But the best state is the real result that I had is usually the third one, the third stage of creativity, which I call letting go. And that's where you no longer think about the problem. You're having a shower, you're just taking a walk in nature or having a bath. And then suddenly everything compounds together and you have the result. And so that's the eureka moment. And I'm sure a lot of people have that. But that's not valued. When I talk about that, I do keynotes and I talk about that, or when I present that to, you know, boards and everything, they understand, but they don't really want to buy that. Like, they, again, they are really outcome driven. But the best outcome from the letting go, so you need a space to create that space to let go. If you're stressed out all the time and you work 60 hours a week because you need to deliver, you don't have that space. And that's where, in my opinion, after 25 years of creativity, that's where the best ideas came.
That's great. You know, playing off this idea too of you know, creating something, I mean, it's whether it be an innovation or be a scenario and foresight, you know, or a strategic plan. What are your thoughts on, you know, this idea of a, you know, kind of top-down mandate on things, you know, like this is the innovation we're moving on, or this is the foresight scenario we're, that we believe is the most, you know, important and best, versus like a more collaborative kind of bottom-up process that gets everyone to be a part of that and buy in on it. Does that make sense? What are your thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, I'm a big believer that, you know, participation and you know, emphasizing the diversity in the process is quite critical and quite essential. And so that's my own bias. But I think actually what that means is there has to be a commitment on the part of the organization or the institution to engage with that complexity. And oftentimes that means confronting the gaps within the organization. So whether that's at a leadership level or kind of structurally within the organization. Oftentimes the framing that I bring to it, it's sort of, you know, and Tyler, I think you'll resonate with this, is to bring kind of the medical kind of metaphor. So, you know, are we sick and we're just trying to take medicine, or are we committed to a lifestyle change that's going to bring us better health? And I think that it's the latter that, you know, in the strategy process, organizations often struggle with, because they'll say, okay, you know what? No, let's do our strategy development process differently. Let's get a better strategy, better priority areas, targets, goals, you know, get those KPIs set, and boom. I say, no, but like, you haven't changed your lifestyle, right? You know, that's where the improvement in health is going to come from, right? So it becomes about, you know, foresight. And I'm using the metaphor increasingly now as a form of hygiene. It's what you have to do to be healthy. And you do hygiene on a daily basis, not, you know, you don't brush your teeth once a week. So I think it's the kind of processes that have to be committed to, and it's blending of the strategic and the tactical. So, you know, you can do different approaches every day. You can use these things, and they don't have to be as labor intensive as a multi-day workshop. You know, there are ways of integrating it as part of kind of a practice, just like you might integrate mindfulness and, you know, your own kind of personal life. So I think that's where I've seen it, is oftentimes these strategy processes are, you know, seen as a one-off thing, whereas, you know, if you can make it something that's more blended, that's more kind of part of an you know, an everyday kind of practice and process, and one, I think people feel more connected, so they're more, you know, more likely to kind of, you know, see it through, and also two, I think it can show better results. But again, that's a lifestyle change, and at an organizational level, that's, you know, that's oftentimes not not easy. It does require, I think, buy-in from throughout the organization, but really a lot of cover. And I think, like Philip had said, a lot of, you know, the psychological safety and openness for openness itself. And that often has to come from the top.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, it's much easier for a leader just to, you know, take their own narrative, their own lens, create their own foresights or their own innovations, and then, you know, top down trying to implement it. But in reality, maybe it's worked in the past, but I don't see that working as well in the future. And it does become more complex when you start adding multiple now narratives, multiple inner lenses, lots of different intentions, the complexity to create safe space for all that becomes harder. But I think, like Philip said, if leaders can take the time to do that work, you know, it's not easy, it's called work, you know, and do the work to create that space and allow those narratives and dialogues to happen, that's when they're going to get the best results. That's when everybody can kind of let go and the best ideas can come forth and everybody's inspired to take action on them. What are your thoughts on that, Philip?
Yeah, I was trying to reflect on that. I really liked the answer of John, and I liked his idea of creating a lifestyle and not, you know, taking, you know, the analogy of medicine and just taking pills to fix the issue or something, and having this kind of a global hygiene. I find that very compelling. I think the main question was, you know, the top down versus collaborative. And I was trying to find an example of both that work, actually. Mm. I think you can have a visionary leader that has a very compelling story, and you just feel that you want to be part of that story. People used to work for Apple and Steve Jobs because he was that visionary. People work for Elon Musk today because he has this very strong vision. And some people don't believe in that, but some people do really believe in it, and they work long hours at, you know, Tesla and other companies because they want to be part of that vision. So if you're a visionary and you have this very big vision and something a bit different, and you have the narrative and storytelling around that, I think there's a place for that. Mm. If you don't have that, I think the best is really the collaborative experience. Mm. And people think, so I'm going to bounce back to what I know, which is the creative work and the you know, design work. People think that designers work on their own and they come back with stuff. And some people do that, actually. But I think the best work you can do as a designer is to really work with the whole team. So many years ago, I was working for a larger corporation, and they didn't quite understand why I was talking to the marketing and the finance team and talking with the general manager and everything. But you cannot design the right product if you don't understand how the product will be displayed on the market and what the marketing department is expecting. If you don't understand what the finance department is expecting from the numbers and the figures perspective, what they are after. And the manager has his own vision. He wants to drive the company in a certain way. If you don't know those information, you cannot really design the right product either. So I think there's a lot of collaboration, and then people need to talk and sometimes disagree. But if you have that place where you can at least share the ideas, share the perspective, then in my opinion, that's where you get the best outcome.
Yeah, I totally agree. And John, any follow-up thoughts on that?
I think, again, I really, really resonate with what Philip is saying, is that there's, you know, the opportunity to find the intersection of the, you know, the kind of the collaborative and this diversity. And it's something that I think to rely on a metaphor from East Asia, you know, the way is made in the walking. And so it's going to look very different depending upon the organization and the people and the leader. And so I think, you know, having an awareness of that contextuality and just really affirming that, you know, you're not trying to solve for X, you know, it's not a formula, it's a recipe, and being open to the process is something that I think takes a real commitment. And I think sounds like Philip's experience is the same. You know, more organizations and leaders are really waking up to this because business as usual isn't working anymore. So there's a real necessity, and I think a real paradigmatic shift in how organizations are starting to, you know, think about the future, starting to, you know, take on innovation to try to link the two together. So it's a really exciting time. And I think, you know, lots of interesting things are happening. And I think out of necessity, right? Because the challenges and the kind of obstacles that we face are really, you know, just extraordinary. So we need this now more than ever.
Great. Well, I want to wrap up here and give you both a chance just to kind of give some final thoughts after today's discussion here. And, you know, what are some key takeaways that you feel are there for leaders to be more intelligent about the future? And Philip, do you want to start?
All right. Okay. I think I'll come back to the self-awareness. If leaders start to really have their own time to practice mindfulness, some type of exercise of self-awareness, have people around them that can also share the truth about their behavior, like, you know, displaying the blind spot and everything. And if they're open to feedback, I think they're going to be really, really good leaders in the future. But the old style of leader that has a forceful way, I think that's over. But I think there's a big place for different tools like meditation or other type of tools where if you develop your really self-awareness, then you're going to build better teams and you're going to build better culture and better businesses.
Great. John?
Yeah, I opened by talking a little bit about, you know, the kind of frames of, you know, curiosity, learning, experimentation, ambiguity, and reflectiveness. And I think what that really is all about is exactly what Philip is saying, is that there's a self-awareness and there's an intentionality of approach that, again, is not often taught in, you know, in the MBA program. So, you know, how do you bring a different sense of self-awareness, which bleeds into an awareness of the operational environment and the kind of, you know, like how you actually manage a large complex organization that I think fundamentally is about, you know, an assessment of kind of self and world. So there is an individual and personal journey that's there, but, you know, when you're leading an organization, it's also about the kind of messaging and the kind of, you know, openness of narrative. And I think that's something, again, that leaders today are finding that they need. And so there's a real gap to be able to, you know, provide that space where leaders can, you know, take that on. So, I think that for me is what really sticks. And again, lots of resonance. So really thankful to have the conversation and the chance to learn. It's been great.
And one last question I'd like to ask everyone is one word that, and I think you've both already kind of said it, but let's see, but one word that you feel like leaders in the future should embody or take to heart. So, Philip?
One word. Empathic, maybe?
Okay, empathic. Mm-hmm. John?
I suppose I would be doing my job if I didn't say foresight, so I'll go with foresight.
Great. Perfect. Well, John and Philip, thank you both for being here today. I really appreciate your time and your insights. It's been really, really fun.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Tyler, too.
Yeah, thanks so much. Had a blast. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs, or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.